Hello, my fans, friends. Welcome to the Rich Herring podcast feed, powered by Acast Plus. Thanks to everyone who's come to see the Can I Have My Ball Back tour so far. It's been going really well. I've got a 4-star review in The Standard, 4-star review in The Telegraph, who once called me the worst comedy experience of the year, so that's a turnaround. People have been coming, people have really been enjoying it, and it's getting better and better. The only gigs this week are both in Pocklington, the town I was born in, near York. There's a couple of tickets left for the evening show and a few more tickets left for the matinee, I think about 4:30. But love to see you there, Yorkshire. Pop along. Check richardherring.com/ballback/tour or richardherring.com/gigs to see if I'm coming near to you. There are tickets left for nearly every show in the tour. I think Norwich has sold out. And a couple of gigs in London could do with your support as well. Anyway, please listen to the podcast. Do spread the news about the podcast to your friends. Listen as much as you can. Numbers are slightly down, which may affect the future of this podcast. So just leave it playing, even if you're not in the room. Love you. Now sit back, relax, and enjoy whatever it is you're going to listen to.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to another Rahalaswa Book Club. I am joined by Natalie Haynes, who's going to be talking about her fantastic book, which I've greatly enjoyed, called Stone Blind, Medusa's Story. Hello, Natalie, how are you doing?
Hello, hello. I am all right, thank you for asking. How are you?
Yeah, I'm pretty good, thank you. Now, I mean, I was going to say last time we saw each other, but that's not true. But when I knew you in the past, you were a stand-up comedian when we first met.
Yes, that is true.
And then you haven't entirely left performance comedy behind, but you've become an author of some renown. Do you want to? Do you want to?
You're so suspicious. How did that happen, Haynes?
Well, it's sort of, you know, it's sort of weird because, like, it doesn't feel like that long. But it is a really long time.
It feels like about 20 minutes, but I quit in 2007, so right. Yeah, 15 years ago.
So in those 15 years, a lot has happened, and I was aware that you were writing books, and I was aware you were doing Radio 4 series, but I don't think I was aware to how amazingly successful you are, which we'll get on to. Do you want to, for those of you,
it's because in real life I look like such a shambles. It just seems inconceivable that anything could be going right behind the scenes.
I just think so many things are going on with people, you know, and like you check back in with them and you go, oh, bloody hell, you're the Prime Minister of the Central African Republic. Do you want to explain a bit about yourself and your journey for people who may not have
who are paying exactly as much attention as you were?
Attention, mate. Yeah,
yeah. So I did stand up. Well, sort of. We kind of overlapped, didn't we, for a while?
Yeah.
So we did a lot of the same Edinburghs because I was there 2002 to 2006. Uh-huh. And then I decided I wanted to sort of move into writing more and gigging less. And so I said, right, that's it. I'm retiring from stand-up. And Marcus Brigstocke said, yeah, you'll be back in 2 years. And I was like, I will not. Don't be stupid. That's sweet of you. I like that you feel that way, but I will not. And then I think it was about 2 years when I was starting to do the sort of work out how I was going to try and sell my first non-fiction book, which is called The Ancient Guide to Modern Life. And that came out in 2010. And I think before it was even out, I was trying to work out how I could kind of perform a version of the book, because right. book festivals basically want you to, they're expecting, they're set up for you to sit and be interviewed or be on a panel. And I'm, you know, I come from stand-up, I'm a massive narcissist, I don't want to share the stage with anyone. I resent it the entire time someone else is on a stage when I am. So I was like, well, surely I could just like give a talk and it'll be more fun than like a lecture. But, and that very rapidly has morphed into what became the radio series Nestle Haynes Stands Up for the Classics. Which we have done 8 series of now.
That's amazing. It's amazing.
Since 2014. Yeah, yeah, it's one of my favourite things at parties is when a man of uncertain calibre decides he will neg me he gets introduced. Usually it's one of those fundraising things, you know, where you're there to try and screw money out of somebody for charity. Not literally in my case, I might add, and certainly not in this instance. And somebody said to this guy, oh, this is Natalie, she writes books and she has a radio show about classics. And he said, oh, and do you get many listeners? And I went, yeah, 1.6 million per episode. He was choked. And I'm like, anyway, strolled off into the sunset, drank champagne on someone else's dollar. It was great. And then, yeah, at the same time, I've been writing sort of novels and nonfiction, so but mainly set in the ancient world or about the ancient world or inspired by the ancient world. So my first novel, Amber Fury, in 2014 is set in contemporary, well, contemporary to then, obviously that's now history, Edinburgh. But it has it's basically a modern retelling of the Oresteia. And then all my other books have been overtly set in the Bronze Age or about the Bronze Age. So that's Children of Jocasta, A Thousand Ships, and the newest one, the Medusa one, Stoneblind. And I wrote a non-fiction book about women in Greek myth too called Pandora's Jar. That's it. Fantastic. That's everything I've done since I last saw you. We were doing the audiobook recordings of our audiobooks. Yes. But in general, that's everything I did since I last saw you.
It's astonishing, and I really loved this book. I wasn't quite sure what to expect, but it's obviously a slightly postmodern take on these myths. And what I always loved about the Greek gods and the Roman gods also is it sort of makes more sense of why the world is how it is. In that it's chaotic and that maybe ruled over by people who don't. My gods, who don't really care.
Petulant people, yeah. I mean, that's from Homer. I didn't even have to be postmodern about that. Quite the opposite. Yeah. The version of the gods that you see in the Iliad are exactly like that. You know, right. And this is a question that's been being asked since, well, I mean, Plato. There's a dialogue called the Euthyphro about piety. And Socrates is in conversation, I guess, with Euthyphro. I can't remember the details. And he says, you know, what's pious? Is it that which the gods love? Or do they love something because it's already kind of pious? And Euthyphro says very confidently, oh, things are pious if the gods love them. And Socrates is like, well, what happens when the gods don't agree? What happens when they love opposite things? Because that happens in the Iliad all the time. And Euthyphro is like, I'm not having a nice time. So, yeah, it's a question that's been being asked for 2,500 years, is how do we cope with a set of gods who all want contradictory things? But it does make much more sense of the chaos that we often sort of find ourselves amid, I think. And also there's something quite wholesome in a way about having gods who have just special areas of expertise. You know, if I'm, you know, desperately wishing I could meet somebody wonderful to fall in love with, and I'm praying to a god who's also in charge of, you know, dealing with Ukraine and world hunger, then I might feel a little trivial. But if I'm making my offerings to Aphrodite, then that's her specific zone of expertise. And if I don't treat her properly, she might punish me, as she does plenty of people, for example, Hippolytus. So, you know, it's just polite. So that it's a safer bet, I think, although obviously, you know, not very rational.
Sure, and I read your interest in the classics began with, as I think it may have done for me, with the film Clash of the Titans.
Yes.
Which I mainly remember for Judy Bowker getting into the bath. I think she played Andromeda, but I'm not even sure about that. But you focused
on the important things, Richard. And it was the lady in the bath.
She was lovely. Judy Bowker, I'd forgotten about her a little bit, and she was... She was a terrific actor and beautiful woman. Because I think like you, the Medusa is such an incredible story. Now, something I was interested in, which you can probably help me with, did the ancient Greeks view these stories as primarily as entertainment or instruction, were they treated with reverence, or was it because they feel very blockbustery, just as stories, right? I know they do turn up as films, but they feel very filmic.
Yeah, well, I think, I mean, they are very cinematic, and they only get more cinematic as they're told and retold. There's a sequence in Aeneid 6 by Virgil, so Roman now, not Greek, but imposing the kind of Greek, imposing Romans into Greek traditions, I guess. And in that sequence where Aeneas goes to the underworld, there's a sequence in Aeneid 6 where he goes into extreme close-ups. So it starts with this sort of wide panning shot of the banks of the River Styx, and then it comes right in close to Charon, the ferryman, and then we're suddenly right in looking at the wrinkles on his face. And it's like, how did you do that when cinema didn't exist? I don't understand. You know, when you had regular human eyes, how did that seem like the way to do this scene? So, right. Yeah, there is something, I think, intrinsically cinematic about these huge, and the epic scope of the Iliad in particular, with its, you know, huge battle scenes where you'll suddenly come in and focus on a duel between two people and then pan back out and, you know, somebody dies and then suddenly we're moving around them and bodies are being collected or fought over or wrangled. It is very cinematic. We can see how this kind of performance of myth was treated, because it happens in a slightly metatextual way inside the Odyssey, which is one of the earliest examples of these myths to survive to us. So Homer is writing in the late 8th, well, composing in the late 8th, early 7th century, so before there's alphabetic writing. Although there is other writing like Linear A and Linear B and hieroglyphs and things. And he is therefore telling the story of Odysseus getting home from Troy, which takes 10 years. But in that story, there are quite often moments where a bard or a rhapsode, to give him his Greek name, performs a song. And there's a bit in, oh, I should know this because I just memorized it for Radio 4, in about Odyssey 8, I think, or 7, 8, I think, where Odysseus is listening to this bard, having just landed in Phaeacia, perform the story of Achilles at Troy, which obviously he had lived through. So he's like a character in the song that he's hearing, and he bursts into tears. And everyone's like, well, who are you? And he's like, oh, all right, books 9 to 12, I'm Odysseus, and here's my story. And so, yeah, there's this sense that these stories are always being told and retold, even by the time the characters that are in them aren't home yet. They're already the subject of this incredible kind of mythic telling. So it would for sure have taken place at a feast, so it could have been quite a formal event. But the ones that we see in the Odyssey, you know, sacrifices are made to the gods, but it's not particularly an act of reverence to have this performance. It's more of an act of communality. You know, everyone comes together, there's eating, there's drinking, and that's how, you know, everyone... I mean, there's no box sets. I don't know what you want me to say. This is how everyone kind of gets involved. And then when you get things like tragedy and comedy, that's much more of a formal performance to gods, because they take place at a festival to Dionysus, the god of wine and theatre, and offerings are made. So there would have been, everyone would have been drunk. There would have been offerings of animals, but so it would have smelled like a barbecue, an abattoir and a barbecue, because you'd be sacrificing the animal and then burning the flesh, and then everybody would be drinking. So, yeah, it'd be quite the night out.
Yeah. And but the characters are so strong, and I think Medusa is, you know, I think probably along with, I loved the Cyclops as a kid. We did a sketch about the Cyclops, but Medusa is so, and I don't know how, to what extent in my mind I've got it a bit conjoined with the Queen in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, who also turned people to stone.
Yes.
I mean, it's been constantly ripped off. I mean,
let me clear this up for you. Turkish Delight, Lion, Witch, Wardrobe. No Turkish Delight, Medusa. You're welcome. That's how I remember them.
I've got a memory of, like, you know, statues of all the people who tried to kill Medusa approaching the caves, but is that The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe?
Must be Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, because Medusa, at least in our extant narrative sources, doesn't kill anyone. I know this is a great shock, because you know, she's supposed to be the uber monster, but in fact she's the uber weapon. So when she has the capacity to petrify or lithify or whichever word you choose, but she seems not to practice it. You know, she doesn't kill the people that she is nearest to, which would be the obvious thing to do. And I think this version of her is dictated by the Harryhausen film, in my view, because in that, when Harry Hamlin as Perseus goes to try and kill her, he and his comrades find her in a cave. They're, you know, preying on her. They're the hunters, but she is hunting them back. She's got a bow and arrow. She's got a slithery, snaky tail. None of this is from our ancient sources. Ancient sources have gorgons, of which there are three, by the way, not one. She's not a solo character. She has wings in our ancient sources, but not a snaky tail. And the snaky tail is so popular that the Lego version of her has a snaky tail. So it has really taken off. And so, yeah, I think we get this sense of her as being very murderous. But actually, if you read, for example, the longest version to survive to us from the ancient world is in Ovid's Metamorphoses, focuses very heavily on Perseus, as one might expect. But in that version, she kills loads of people after she's been killed. She's used as a weapon very successfully by Perseus. But that for sure is not the same thing as her being a killer, I think.
No. And so with this book, it's very much seeing things from her point of view, and not questioning what is a monster and what our view of a monster is. Also, Perseus becomes much more of an anti-hero. He's much more of an idiot than perhaps
he is a lot of an idiot. But I think in part, in part, is because there's a kind of there's an impossibility of communication. So the kind of fun bit of this book to write, the funner bits of it, because, you know, a lot of it is very harrowing. Medusa isn't a monster. She is the first monstered survivor of sexual assault. You know, she is literally turned into a monster as punishment because she has been raped in a temple. So some of it was really harrowing to write, and I cannot lie, but some of it was an absolute ball. And the bits that were an absolute ball were the bits where I was trying to make, because Perseus is, he's a demigod. He's the son of Zeus and a mortal woman named Danae. And so he gets loads of help in every version of his story from the ancient world, from loads of different gods. He's borrowed shoes from Hermes, a hat from Hades. He's got Athene offering him advice. The Hesperides have lent him his backpack. You know, he's got a huge roster of gods. And so, you know, generally that's presented to us as like, look how favoured he is because all these gods line up to help him. And of course, my opening kind of position was, why does he need quite so many gods to help him? Is it because he's a bit useless? And so the problem for him, anyway, in my version, is that he's always having to negotiate with immortal beings who cannot begin to understand his concerns, and nor would they ever try. Because why should they? You know, they're alive forever. His lifespan is like 10 seconds tops to them. And so they're not really bothered. So to them, he seems incredibly stupid. And to him, they seem incredibly heartless. But actually, I hope it's just because their worlds, they collide, but they never fit. And so, but it was fun to do. It was fun to write him. It was fun to write him dim, I'm not going
to
lie.
It's a lot of fun to read him dim. And I think to think of it that way, you know, because even the minute you start thinking about his quest is to basically stop his mum marrying someone he doesn't want his mum to marry.
Yes.
And he's going out to murder someone in order to do that. It seems there's a disparity between what he's trying to achieve and the chaos he causes on the way to do this. So it's a great observation, and it's, you know, it's and absolutely although, you know, how much did they mean this at the time, or how much did they just let it fly? But obviously, Greek myth is just basically a series of sexual assaults, and
certainly if you read the Metamorphoses, then what you get is just one example of Zeus and occasionally Poseidon or Apollo or somebody assaulting a young woman or occasionally a young man. Yeah. After another, and it is incredibly, once you look at it in those terms, I mean, the unifying theme of the Metamorphoses is transformation. It's nymphs or people or gods being transformed from one form of existence to another. Sometimes you change to an animal like Actaeon, sometimes you change into a tree like Daphne, but you could equally well say that the unifying theme almost always is, and then someone tried to sexually assault them and they turned into a tree trying to avoid it, or they were turned into a tree because they had been, and so on. So, I mean, it's an incredibly, the past and indeed the present is an incredibly violent place for people who don't have very much power, where there are predatory gods or men in play. So, it's always present. And what's, in a way, the most sympathetic thing about Perseus is that he isn't like that at all, as I've written him, that he isn't remotely sexually predatory, which you know makes him unusual for a son of Zeus, frankly.
but you know, it does mean that, I mean, obviously this is a sort of feminist approach to the subject, or at least it's this history from a woman's perspective. It comes across, it's very easy to do that because the men are all so awful in it, but so Athena's, you know, pretty Athena's pretty awful.
She is, yeah. Although I do still, I mean, this is my secret. I'm afraid I always love all of them, even the worst ones, even the men. I love them all when I'm writing from their perspective. Because if I don't, then that I'm only going to write caricatures. You know, they have to have feelings and be people. Even the ones who are gods, even the ones who are monsters, have to, you know, see themselves at least as sympathetic. Because otherwise, you know, there won't be any depth to the writing. So, yeah, in the moments, I'm really interested to see how people are responding to Athena already, because it's really 50-50 people going, I love her, she is my favourite, and she is so monstrous, how could you do it? And you're like, oh, well, I guess that's probably about right.
You know, but it's both, and, you know, but I wonder to what extent the people who created these myths were judging in that way as well, or was that just the mindset that, you know, that if you are a god or if you are a king or if you are a man, that if you can take those things, you can take them? Or is there an... Because Zeus, you know, his sort of sexual incontinence is not incredibly admirable. And I wonder if it ever...
I'm sure it isn't uncommon either, though, if you see what I mean, in a world where men had so much power and where slavery is so... I realise there are more enslaved people in the world today than there were in the ancient world, but there are more people full stop in the world today. Yeah. And so the open acceptance of slavery means you have power over human beings as though they were objects or furniture or something. And so that immediately makes rape and assault a commonplace. You know, slaves were beaten to death by people. You know, these things did happen and didn't happen in an unusual way. I guess the myths arise across a really long period of time in a really huge geographical space, which is why they're always so contradictory, why you can't ever find a single timeline that makes sense of Helen or Achilles, or and certainly not the gods. You can't even find a coherent timeline within a single artwork sometimes of a god. You'll find something from like later in their existence, or, you know, that they pick up in a battle as they go into a battle, and you're like, wait, what? So you're constantly having to impose boring human time on gods who don't seem to employ it, let's say, or be bound by it. But the question that you're asking dates back to, again, at the very earliest, or at the very latest, rather, the 5th century, because it comes up in the Melian dialogue in Thucydides' History of the Peloponnesian War, where Melos wants to stay neutral in the Peloponnesian War between Athens and Sparta in the south. Athens says, no, you've got to be on our side. And Melos says, well, we'd like to be neutral. We'd like to be, and in the future someone will describe us as Switzerland. Can we do that, please? And the Athenians say no. And they say, well, then what will you do? And the Athenians say, well, we'll crush you. You know, we'll kill all the men and we'll enslave all the women and children. And the Melians say, but if you do that, what will happen when you don't have power? You know, you'll have set this precedent that this is how the powerless or the less powerful are treated. And, you know, the Athenians are completely icy in the face of it. And their response is, you know, that the strong do what they want and the weak take what they must. And it's a pretty brutal way of looking at the world, but a very accurate view of how empire works, I'm afraid. And so an imperial power, which Athens is in the 5th century, essentially has the power to do whatever it wants, and a little island state saying, oh, we'd like to be neutral, please, doesn't cut any ice with them at all.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's an incredibly entertaining book. It does cover some big subjects and some harrowing subjects, but very artfully, I think. And you know, it's great to turn Medusa into this incredibly sympathetic and deep character, and you know, and all the stuff that goes around Medusa as well, her head and her snakes and everything. Though it's, you know, there's lots of funny stuff. I might pronounce this wrong. The grey eye of the three old women who share a tooth and an eye. It's a very sort of funny conceit, and you get lots of fun out of it. I have to say as well, it feels like a sort of Monty Python thing, but I suppose in reality Monty Python is taking almost something like the in the Holy Grail. There's that knight that shares three bodies, all sharing one, three heads sharing one body. It's almost like they've taken this as their source rather than the other way around. But
yeah, or Cerberus, I suppose, three-headed dog, or Scylla, who's a six-headed monster. So sure. Yeah, multiple heads and single bodies are quite common in the sort of monstrous bit of, you know, the Greek myth has loads of those hybrid monsters where it's part of one animal and part of another, and you often get either things that are gigantism or miniaturism, so something much too big, something much too small, and multiple appendages on a single body is another of those ways in which monsters tend to be created. So yeah, in a way, Gorgons are unusual because they are Gorgon heads, Gorgonea, predate Gorgons. So we get loads of examples of them in visual arts from before we get any narrative involving a whole Gorgon. And for example, Agamemnon has a Gorgon head, a Gorgoneion is the word in Greek, on his shield in the Iliad. So there's this sense of a sort of disembodied head. And that can be connected way back to Gilgamesh. You know, there's a decapitated monster, Humbaba, in that.
Right.
And so, you know, there have been lots of attempts to explain why these Gorgon heads appear in places where they seem to be maybe to scare you away, as in on a shield, for example, but also maybe to protect you. I mean, a shield has two jobs, right? To scare your enemy, but also to protect the person holding it. And Gorgons seem to serve the same dual function. They appear to be both terrifying and apotropaic, protective of the person who has them on their side. And when you look at the earlier versions of them in particular, you can see loads of connections with the natural world. So they tend to have these very, very wide mouths and lolling tongues, and they're associated with making a thunderous noise. So that seems to be how that works. Also, the snakes for hair, obviously. Sometimes when you see the hair sort of all mushed up, you can see there's a lion's mane there too, you know, that's what it looks like. They often have big tusks like boar, beards sometimes like wild pigs. So it seems to be the case that they're designed to protect us from the natural world, from all the things that threaten us in the natural world. Snake bites killed people in both myth and reality. You know, wild cats or mountain cats, mountain lions, dangerous. Wild boar, I mean, Odysseus has a huge scar on his inner thigh as part of his great recognition scene from a boar hunt when he was a young man. Adonis, out of Aphrodite and Adonis, or Venus and Adonis, dies because of a boar tusk. So, you know, these encounters with the natural world are much more dangerous in the ancient world than they are to us now, I guess. And so Gorgons are part of the way they reflect the fears of the societies which create them.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you really bring they're fantastic stories. It's obviously great to work with this kind of source material, because the characters and the
cast
and
of thousands.
Well, the situations are great, but you also, it's put together so artfully, and it absolutely, you know, I only had a few days to read this book, and I did it easily because I was absolutely kind of wrapped by it. It's really fantastically written, and you know, and reminds you know, I think like probably our generation had a bit of classical teaching at school. I don't know whether future generations after us had it quite so much, but it reminded me of lots of stories. I went to check some of them to see if they were, if you'd made anything up. I mean, obviously, you know, like you say, there's lots of different versions, isn't there? Because in your version, I think the lovely touch, I think, that you do, which you presumably have got from somewhere, but it's not the version I remember, is Perseus throwing away the eye and the tooth.
Oh, yeah, that's me, I'm afraid.
Yeah, no, I love just that.
Because what are you going to do with them? You're holding a disgusting eye and a horrible tooth. And my version of him is so squeamish. And so they are so revolting to him. I'm afraid.
No, but that's great. But also, it really highlights how he doesn't need, you know, once he's got them, he doesn't need to be. I mean, he isn't maybe in the original, but he doesn't need to be so mean. He doesn't need to trick them. Once he's tricked them, he doesn't need to. You know, he can let them see and chew their food, whatever. But yeah, it makes him into a spoiled. He's a sort of spoiled little. You know, yeah. God's son,
spoiled.
Isn't he?
Yeah, so yeah, I'm afraid he is. So
it's terrific. Well, look, I really want people to discover most of this stuff themselves, so I'm not going to go too deeply into it. But it's you know, you can tell why these books are so successful. When I met you at doing the audiobooks, I was doing signings for my book,
in which
I had to sign 500 copies of front pieces of my book, which I thought was a bit much.
Yeah,
and you
I
were
really
telling...
felt for you. Yeah. Oh wait!
And you were telling me that you were halfway through doing 12,000 signing.
Yeah, it ballooned up to over 13 in the end. So it was my whole, and it was during the heat wave. So my flat was just full of, and it was like trying to sign. This is such a first world problem, but it's like I'm trying to sign a piece of paper, and it's sort of wilting in my hands of my boiling hot flat, which is, I might add, still now 10 degrees hotter than the outside world because it faces south. So yeah, but yeah, no, I did sign a lot. I can't deny it. If you're looking for a copy of this book, I think it's just about the case that an unsigned one is less rare than a signed one, but there's not a lot in it.
it speaks of how popular they are and they've become, and obviously it's a worldwide thing. And I've seen you've had quite, I mean, you've got a quote from Margaret Atwood.
I actually do, yeah, that was a really good day. Yeah,
incredible. So I mean, if that happened to me, which is doubtful, especially after the jokes I've made about her, she can sign. I'm gonna go do it again. She can sign remotely, and she's got a special machine where she I riffed a little bit on that idea, and I hope Margaret.
Did you,
Edward,
Richard?
I hope Margaret,
did you?
I hope Margaret Edward never sees that, and will give me a quote. I can see why she likes. I think she's absolutely the greatest living author, but
yep.
I can see why she would like your book, because I think, you know, it is. If Margaret Atwood had written this, if it said Margaret Atwood on the front, I would sort of believe it still.
Oh, that's a lovely thing to say.
I think it's up there. So,
thank you.
But so you're doing stuff. You're selling lots of copies in America, which is probably
the plan. This one doesn't come out there until February next year, right. February 23. So I have some very grumpy American fans going, when's it here? It's like, it's February. But it's because there was a really long delay between 1,000 ships in the UK and 1,000 ships in the US, because it took a really long time to sell ships in America because nobody thought there'd be a market for it, which turned out not to be the case. So that was good. But they all said no. I mean, so many people said no to ships. So by the time they'd said yes, it took nearly 2 years for it to come out there.
Right.
And then, so we've been trying to kind of squash the gap ever since. So I think Pandora's Jar came out here in October 2020, and they had it in, I should know this really, earlier this year, February this year, March this year, something like that. And then, so Stoneblind came out here in mid-September, and it'll come out there in mid-February. So we are decreasing the gap quite quickly, book by book, but it can't all be done at once because publishing's just not that speedy a business.
And so how did that feel when it got published in America and was a hit in America? What makes that happen?
I don't really know. That's the thing that people don't really allow for, right. And it's quite difficult because I had been published in America before. Ancient Guide was published there, and Amber Fury, which was called The Furies there, and Children of Jocasta, and they had all flopped really badly, you know. And when we were waiting for 1,000 ships to come out in the US, people kept saying, oh, you know, this time it'll be, and I just felt, since we've gone there already, I just felt like that Monty Python bit where he goes, he says, I built a castle, and then it sank, and then I built another one, and that sank, and then I built another one, and that caught fire, and then it sank. It was like, yeah, I have done this with my books. I know what it's like to fail in America. I have copious and extended practice. And then when Ships came out, it had already been shortlisted for the Women's Prize here, which I think made a difference. And it had been such a long gap, as I say, that I sort of vaguely worried that people would have lost interest. But actually, it had sort of gone the other way. You know, it was shortlisted for the Women's Prize in the April after it had been published the previous May. So it was published May 19. It was shortlisted April 20. So when it came out in the US in maybe January, I think, 21, they'd been waiting months going, well, apparently this book is great because it's been shortlisted for a big prize. When can we have it? And so there was a lot of pent up excitement, I think, when it came out. And so that really helped it along. And I guess that there's a real passionate reading of myth community lurking around online. And that really helped. And then so, you know, so it sold really well and everybody was really happy. But they still weren't clamoring even then for Pandora's Jar, the non-fiction book which followed it. And then my fiction publishers decided that they would publish it. And then when they did, Barnes & Noble, which is the big, you know, chain bookstore in the US, made it their book of the month. And I have no idea which person made that decision, but to say that they've literally changed my life is simply not an exaggeration. It's like, at some point I really owe them a drink.
But that's interesting, isn't it? It might, guess, you know, these things, because, you know, even something like Harry Potter, it came down to one person picking that book off a pile and going with it a little bit, didn't it? It's really hard to
think in those terms, because it makes you accept how arbitrary it is.
Yeah.
But it's really arbitrary. And so you have to sort of accept that that's the case. You know, the Barnes & Noble pick had it boosted up to, at one point this year, it was number 2 in the New York Times bestseller. I can't even say it now without laughing. It's like, what? And you look at like the top, they have a top 15 there, rather than a top 10, and all the other books were like really serious books which you'd expect, like proper history about Winston Churchill, or, you know, I don't know, there was the book that was at number 1, I'm sure it still is because it's been there for about a million years, was about how your body processes trauma, emotional trauma and physical trauma. And so there were loads of books that you would really expect it. And I just had this sort of image in my head of my book going into a sort of drinks party where all these respectable books were. And my book is like wearing a big mustache and a hat and like, what? I belong here. Because it just seemed so mad. And I kept doing interviews where people were saying, so obviously when you set out to write your feminist version of Greek myths, you knew it would be a bestseller. You go, no, not really. Not going to lie. Not so much, actually. I've been wanging on about this for ages. Nobody was interested at all.
Well, it is a little, it has hit a sort of zeitgeist, I think, but I think also just, you know, it's arbitrary, but equally, I think something has to be really good as well. There may be tens or hundreds of fantastic books out there that don't get picked off that pile or don't get to the right person, but I think eventually, you know, when someone, I think someone, you know, if you pick up, having not read any of the others, having, you know, going into this one, if this was on a book and a pile and I was deciding what I was going to promote in my bookshop, I would be very excited about, you know, if I discovered this. So I think when something's good, you have a better chance of that one person that matters chancing across it,
you
finding
have to
it.
Hope.
And,
yeah,
but
yeah,
it, but,
you
it,
have
but
to
it
hope.
Takes, but it's, you know, but it's all equally, it's not good, but it's reassuring to other authors, I would say, that it took a few goes for
it
that
really
to happen.
Did. And a lot of times I feel it's in the literary world, it's vaguely vulgar to talk about money, I know, but because I come from comedy and I'm basically therefore in mindset a grocer, I don't have that issue with it at all. And I think it's really important to acknowledge the role of luck, you know, and that's not, it's like Aristotle is really big on how you need luck in order to thrive. So again, not a new concept, but it's an important one because people spend a lot of time responding as though, you know, you have control over it. And I really, really don't. I only have control over the bit that I do, which is making the best work I can do. But I've always done that. And I'd always done that with the books that weren't really successful. And I did it with the stand-up shows before then. And you've watched me fall apart in Edinburgh because, you know, people are coming, but it doesn't really feel like anything's happening. And it's like, I was always trying my hardest. That's the one thing you can say about me is I'm a massive trier the whole time. It never stops.
Yeah.
But you just need to be lucky. And if you're not, that you can't buy that back. You know, I'm lucky already that I don't have other responsibilities that I need to, you know, I don't have a day job so I can write all day if I want to, that I don't have caring responsibilities so I can write because of that. But there are lots of people who don't have that good fortune. And so when people say to me, oh, you make your own luck, it's like, yeah, in a way, because I'm always at my desk and I'm always working. But there's a huge element that's outside of my control. And I should acknowledge that. And honestly, so should they, I think. It seems a bit, I don't know, it seems a bit crass to me to just walk around everywhere. You know, that whole kind of, oh, yeah, the more I practice, the luckier I get. Yeah, that's true. But also, you still need to get lucky.
You do. And I think sometimes people just, you know, especially with comedy, I don't know if it's true of writers as much. But, you know, it's sort of a, you have to have a lot of self-belief to push yourself through this. Mm. And so if you do become successful, it's very easy to go, yes, I was always destined for this and I deserve this. And, you know, and then to go even more off the scale. So it's good that you've got it in perspective. Equally, you could argue, you know, you were a very fine stand-up and still are a very fine stand-up. And the bad luck of maybe those shows not being as recognised as they could have been is that if your stand-up career had taken off to the extent that you didn't move into writing books, you wouldn't have had, you know. So often something going wrong or something not working, the bad luck is part of the process.
Yeah. So, no, you know, I think that's probably true. And the nice thing about stand-up, of course, is that we all know really from personal experience how much it can just be not up to you that it doesn't work out that night. You know, there are days, and I never really resolved it as a sort of theoretician. I just resolved it as a performer, like internally, I think. But I never could see it from the outside. But there were days when I felt really nervous and I walked on stage and it came across as being really diffident or, you know, nervy, or and the gig went badly. But there were other days when I felt just the same on the inside, but it came across as really appealing, like, oh, who's this cute girl who's trying her best but she's shy. And there were days when I felt really confident and it was like, great, this confident performer is ruling the gig. And other days where people went, she is so arrogant, I hate her. And you think, well, I was the same on both of those days. And so I think comedians of all people really understand that you can only control the bit that's you. You know, you can only control the stuff that you can control. If you turn up and the room has just turned before you get there, you can do a lot, but you still can't necessarily save it.
Yeah, I think what's interesting about that, when you do Edinburgh and you talk to people after gigs, a lot of times everyone has the same kind of audience on the same night, so there's obviously it's about the news or the weather, or, you know, something in the way people are. It's weird that, like, the way the gigs the podcast I did this week, and which we're recording this only about a few days before this goes out, but in between the Queen dying and the Queen's funeral, the audience was so up for comedy, I think. And so, like, sometimes something being a terrible thing happening or something that affects everyone's psyche in that way can actually just ramp up the tension for comedy, and everyone's really, really delighted to have comedy. You know, I had an exceptional gig. It was pretty good guests with the podcast, but it was, you know, an exceptional audience, and so it's a weird thing. And I guess with a book, that's you know, apart from someone might be in a bad mood when they read it, and not in the mood, and that's certainly, you know, there's certainly books I've picked up that I've not enjoyed for whatever reason, and come back to them a few months later and thought they were the best thing ever. So, you know, obviously there's that on an individual level where you might not be ready for the book or not be in the right place for it. But yeah, it's sort of interesting, isn't it? Because as a comedian, you revel in that immediate reaction from the audience, and then when you write a book, you don't know.
It kills me still now that you have to wait so long for some. You know, the joy of comedy is that you can walk on stage and think of the joke as you're there, and find out immediately if it's good or not. And, you know, you might then fuck it up for the next 10 performances and spend it, but you know that it was once good and you can probably get it back if you just work out how to time it the way you did the first time, or bring whatever you brought the first time. And whereas with a book, you know, you're there for so long. You know, 90,000 words takes me, I don't know, between 10 and 12 months to write. It's a long time to not have any. And this is book 7, is that right? Yeah, 7. So it's like, I've been here before. I've dug my way out of this before. But there's still no guarantee that you'll do it right this time, and certainly with Stoneblind, which is, as you say, it has a lot of tonal changes in it. So it goes from being very serious, very sad, you know, then very funny, I hope. And so it was like, it felt like such a sort of high wire act. It's like, I really need to make sure I get you through these changes in mood without you going, wait, what? I need to kind of make you feel like you're going up and down in a way which is enjoyable, not slamming you into a wall with the kind of sudden shift. And that was really, and then of course you're just waiting, and you know, the whole, the more and the further through you get, the heavier the book becomes, because you've got this entire world that you're sustaining and all these characters and everything that's happening to them, and nobody can look at it until you're done, because all you can say to people is, it's going to be really good, I just have to get through this thing. So that by the time you get to the last sort of 10,000-15,000 words, it feels like running downhill with something enormous following you. It's like, oh, I've got to outrun it, but it feels like it gets very tricky. I miss that instant endorsement of stand-up such a lot.
Is it like having a Gorgon's head in a bag that you're trying to get?
It's not like that, because I would never be so unkind.
It feels like it's got to be like a film version of this from this perspective. I know this has been films before, but is that something that's in the pipeline for these books?
Yeah, I don't know. They would be so expensive to film, because you know, they're a huge cast, multiple outdoor sets and loads of monsters, so you'd need loads of CGI. So yeah, I think you'd have to have a lot of money before you committed to this one.
Who make these things, I mean, you know, it's got that sort of, you know, because of the scope, because Lord of the Rings is the same as the Greenlits, and because Game of Thrones is sort of this kind of thing as well, you know, it is possible to make these things. I think, you know, it feels like, certainly with this one, I think the Medusa story from Medusa's point of view is such a great pitch that I would hope it would come off.
We'll see. I mean, you know, they've been done. Ships was done on stage a couple of times as a sort of full version, so like 11 hours long or something, and that was really good fun. But yeah, I mean, that's a tough one again, because it's all war and tragedy. Yeah. so yeah, I don't know. I hope someone wants to adapt this, but who knows? I still feel at that point where it's like, so that's probably where I am.
We'll see. Hopefully it will. I'm jealous of you that you're getting to present Time Team.
Oh yeah, I couldn't do this year though, because I've had to be away on a book tour. So, yeah, that I would have been there last weekend when I was starting the tour if I'd been able to do the dig. So yeah, I had an absolute ball, and Gus Casely Hayford is, on the record and off it, the nicest man alive. So I, as much as anything else, I miss working with Gus. I miss being with Lawrence and Derek, the archaeology boys. I miss all of them, but I just couldn't fit any more things into this autumn. So, yeah, I hope I'll get to work with them again next year. But, yeah, this year I've missed them. I've missed standing around in a field, staring at a thing, going, "What is that?"
It's a dream. It's
now,
a dream.
What is that?
It's a dream job, Natalie. I can't think of anything better than getting that job.
It was such a laugh.
Well done. Even if it's over and you can't do it anymore because you're too successful.
They might have me back next year. I don't know.
I'm presuming
they probably replace me. There's probably some younger, thinner version of me standing next to a, you know, big dig site somewhere, going, "Oh yeah, that looks really cool," and then wearing a Snoopy t-shirt, and I'll be like, "Ah."
What other books? I mean, you obviously are extremely well read. I don't know if there are any more ancient texts that you haven't read, but what kind of books do you read, and is there anything you're reading at the moment that you'd like to recommend?
What am I reading at the moment? This whole desk is such a pit, I dare not turn the laptop round to show you, but I am currently reading Magic in, how do I move that to make it work? Sorry everyone at home, I'm incredibly thick about this. Magic in Ancient Greece and Rome.
Okay.
With a lovely picture of Circe, I think, on the cover. Is that Circe? I should know this, really. Yes, it is. yes, because of a future project, Richard.
Okay, terrific.
Which, of course, is murdering people, I just haven't said. Oh, no, giving it away.
You said you would, you might do a little reading for us. Would that be something?
Oh, I will if you
from
want.
Your book?
Yeah,
that'd
like
be nice.
That?
Yeah, that would be very nice, because I think it's a beautifully written book.
Thank you very much. The audiobook is me, so everyone gets to hear me do this if they want to.
Yes.
Obviously, if you don't want to, you can listen to it on Radio 4, where it's been abridged and is performed by the infinitely more talented Susanna Fielding. So that's an option for you as well. There you go. So this is the very beginning. Gorgoneion. I see you. I see all those whom men call monsters. And I see the men who call them that. Call themselves heroes, of course. I only see them for an instant. Then they're gone. But it's enough. Enough to know that the hero isn't the one who's kind or brave or loyal. Sometimes, not always, but sometimes, he is monstrous. And the monster? Who is she? She is what happens when someone cannot be saved. This particular monster is assaulted, abused, and vilified. And yet, as the story is always told, she is the one you should fear. She is the monster. We'll see about that.
Very good. It's a great opening. And
thanks. I always want to add ba 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 to the end of every opening chapter I ever write.
Yeah, and you should.
That's I what can my... never resist it every single time. You should just have the EastEnders drums at the end.
That's what my daughter does that when she writes through. I type them and she reads them to me, and I have to put dun 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 in quite a lot, which I do enjoy, and I hope she correct. Never loses that. Look, thanks so much, Natalie, for talking to us.
It's been my pleasure.
I can't recommend the book enough, and I wish I didn't have to read a book every week for this stupid podcast, or I'd go back and read all of your other ones straight away. But I'll try and fit them in at some point in the future.
But I get to read yours soon because I'm interviewing you at Hay for the Hay Winter Weekend in November, which I'm looking forward to enormously. Will you be bringing your puppet, Richard?
I will bring my puppet. I will bring my puppet for you. And there's, if I remember, and there's one point of crossover in our books in that I discuss very briefly Athena's. The spunk on the spunk when she gets spunked up by the blacks.
How would I ever have thought it could be any other bit of her story than that?
It is relevant to my
never change, Richard.
and then a child grows from the woolen. So I thought this sounds familiar. I've written about it in my book, The Blacksmith God, and you can't get pregnant from a blacksmith coming on your thigh. Is what you've learned
from this.
That's what I would say to people, but that's not what the myths say. Anyway, thank you very much, Natalie Haynes. Thank you to Chris Evans, not that one, for all your hard work. I'm not quite sure who the guest is next week, but it will be someone fantastic. Thank you very much for listening. Goodbye.
This message comes from BOF sponsor eBay. You'll know real when you get it. It'll say eBay Authenticity Guarantee. And you'll feel it. Maybe it's a head-turning handbag, a watch that says it all, jewelry that makes you look like the gem, or sneakers and streetwear so fresh every step feels fly. eBay gets it. So look for the blue check mark next to that thing you love. And be confident that every inch, stitch, sole, and logo is checked by experts. With eBay Authenticity Guarantee, you can trust that feeling of real is always in reach. Ensure your next purchase is the real deal. Visit ebay.com for terms.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Thanks for listening. RichardHerring.com/gigs. GoFasterStripe.com for all my books, downloads, all that sort of shizzle. Oh, yeah, I know all the cool words. And would love to see you on the Can I Have My Ball Back tour if you can make it. Bye.